The American public had seen so much fear, isolation, hospitalization, and death that they were prepared to take mass casualties and injury with the vaccine. Medical care is off its rockers. And I can tell you, when doctors come out of their trance, they are in a vaccine trance right now. They are in a different zone. Doctors, when I look them in the eyes, they look cloudy. They look foggy, like they know something's wrong. They know they're doing something wrong. They're kind of disturbed, but they can't seem to come out of their trance. Other doctors like me, they can see it very clearly. We would never, you give me a vial of a dangerous substance and say inject it into a pregnant woman. I won't do it. I took an oath. I swore a Hippocratic oath as a doctor. I would never do that. Stop it. Stop it right now before more people are hurt. It's not working and is causing tremendous damage.
What is your overall assessment of the vaccines at this point across all the various metrics? Are they safe? Are they effective? Let's start with, are they safe? How do we know whether they're safe or not? What safety protocols are in place? What oversight is there? And I guess, you know, later we can talk about the VAERS system, you know, and what that means. Does it overcount? Does it undercount? What's your assessment right now? Have you been seeing patients who have taken the vaccine?
Well, certainly I have. And so let me just say that in April-May timeframe, it became known that the virus was going to be amenable to a vaccine. So actually antibodies directed against the spike protein, which is the little spicule or the little spine that sticks out of the ball of the virus, antibodies directed against the spike protein were what's called neutralizing. It means that they could kind of freeze the virus and prevent the virus from basically invading the body. So that was good news to understand that, in fact, neutralizing antibodies could be raised. Many viruses are not amenable to neutralizing antibodies. We actually can't generate the antibodies to stop the virus. SARS-CoV-2, that was the case. Now, the next decision was how to actually platform a vaccine. Well, what happened in overseas was just to take the virus and kill the virus and inject it as a vaccine. So just the whole virus killed, and that was called the Sinovac vaccine. And so that was used across India and South America, et cetera. Another method would be to just take the genetic code for the spike protein and then load it into another virus. And like, for instance, an adeno-associated virus, what have you, and then kind of load it in there and see if we could actually get the body to take in a different virus and take up the material, if we could actually control that viral vector, and then have the body generate the spike protein. That became a Sputnik, as an example, out of Russia. So believe it or not, there was other vaccines that came ahead of the U.S. vaccine program. But what was chosen in the United States is what's called gene transfer technology platforms. And we had probably several dozen of them. And they featured either adenoviral DNA platforms or messenger RNA platforms. And they were designed to actually deliver genetic material in the human body and then have the body take up that material and change in a way. Most of it was designed to replace a defective gene. So an example, there's a condition called Fabry's disease that affects the heart and the kidneys. And some of these messenger RNA platforms were designed to treat Fabry's disease. They were going to replace alpha-galactosidase. They were going to replace a gene that was deficient. Or to treat cancer, where a genetic manipulation could actually augment a response to cancer. Or treat heart failure. So a lot of these platforms, and these have been around. Seminal papers were published back in the 1980s on this. So these have been around for a long time. They all failed. They actually all could not deliver that critical gene replacement. But the idea was, could we actually take the genetic code for the spike protein and load it in one of these platforms, have the body take it up, and then the body would take up the genetic material, the body would produce the spike protein, the body would respond to the spike protein, and then develop immunity against SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. So that was the pipe dream, and that became the central focus of Operation Warp Speed. So once that came along, we kind of saw other projects die. There was less of an interest, or really no interest, on early treatment. There actually was reduced interest on inpatient treatment. It was all about the vaccine, the vaccine, the vaccine. We heard this month after month after month. People, Americans were told, listen, stay at home, wear a mask, stay in lockdown, and wait for the vaccine. So we waited, and we waited. And then it was announced the leaders became Pfizer, Moderna, and they came forward with what's called messenger RNA platform. So it's messenger RNA in a lipid nanoparticle. And then what was created was the formulation of how this was going to be injected into the body. And so there were registrational trials were done. They were very similar, and they were very large. So remember I told you treatment trials, we needed trials of 20,000 patients. We needed those trials. Never had them. Never had it. But for the vaccines, oh my Lord, we had trials of 45,000 patients. We had trials of 18,000, 16,000 in each group. We had massive clinical trials, and people rushed forward for these trials. They signed up for the trials, and they either got placebo or they got the vaccine. And then we watched, and we waited to see what was happening. And it turns out the shocker was in November when the top line data came out in the press releases from both programs. What we learned is, less than 1% of individuals who received the vaccine or received placebo, less than 1% ever got COVID-19. And I've never seen a clinical trial in my life where you do a study and you expect some type of rates of something in both groups to be less than 1%. It was like, wait a minute, how did that happen? How did they get people? I mean, we had lab positivity rates in the fall of 5%, 10%, 15%. We were seeing this on the news, like COVID-19 is steaming across America, but yet the vaccine programs recruited amazingly sterilized people, assiduous people who are not coming in contact with COVID-19. So the clinical trials worried me a little bit that, wait a minute, this isn't a very good challenge. If these people are vaccinated, and even in placebo, they're not getting COVID-19. It's not a very good challenge. But having said that, the rates of COVID-19 between placebo and the actual product was about a 90% reduction, 90% vaccine efficacy. And this is what we heard, 90%, 90%. But the absolute reduction was less than 1%. So the relative, so this became a selling point. Well, it's a vaccine efficacy rate of 90%, but the absolute reduction is less than 1%. What your listeners need to know is when we apply this to a population, we can only apply the absolute reduction, never the vaccine efficacy rate. So Americans thought that this was going to wipe out 90% of COVID-19. Who wouldn't think that because they were sold on this 90% reduction? Having said that, it looked like there was a sore arm, fever, rates of hospitalization and death were similar between placebo and the vaccine, and these received emergency use authorization. Now, doctors didn't have much of a say in terms of who got the vaccine because doctors didn't order it. It wasn't administered in doctor's offices. There were vaccine centers set up, and people were told, come on in and get the vaccine. So patients would go in, and they weren't given too much guidance. You know, should it be Pfizer? Should it be Moderna? It was pretty much what was offered, and people took the vaccine. Americans were actually kind of encouraged to do this. They were told to do this, and they faithfully did through December, January, February. And I have to tell you, I was watching the data, and the CDC on its website and in the consent form to patients tells them, listen, we don't know if this is going to work. We don't know if it's safe, but go to VAERS, go to Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and you look at the data and you decide yourself. The CDC has been telling doctors and mid-level providers, nurses, and patients, look at VAERS. It's all over the whole website. It's all over the consent form, and that's what we did. Now, interestingly, this program is under emergency use authorization. The research, so it's research. The research sponsors are the Center for Disease Control and the U.S. FDA. We've never had two government bodies together be a sponsor of a major research program. Now, the National Institutes of Health have been a sponsor, but this case, it was the CDC and FDA. They're the implementing arms, but now they're the research sponsor. And shockingly, they did not have, and to this day, they've never put together an external critical event committee, an external data safety monitoring board, or a human ethics committee. They had these committees, by the way, in the registrational trials. They had them. And these are standard. I'm telling you, every large clinical investigation has these three committees. In fact, I chair many of these committees for pharmaceutical companies and for the National Institutes of Health. I'm a household name, so I'm in this business of reviewing safety data. Well, you know, Americans, I think, should have had at least weekly, if not monthly, reviews of safety to assure Americans that the vaccines were safe. So the idea, it was a compressed timeline. You know, the typical vaccine timeline, minimum observation period would be 24 months from prior regulatory guidance. It was compressed to 2 months. And, you know, many things, there were many questions still left to be answered. You know, did they cause cancer? Did they cause birth defects? Did any of the genetic material change the human genome? Now, the registrational trials were careful. They excluded pregnant women, women of childbearing potential who couldn't guarantee contraception. They excluded COVID recovered patients because you can't get COVID again. They excluded patients who had positive antibodies, suspected COVID. So they had a pretty clean population. And you know, even though over a short period of time, it was my judgment as a doctor that they looked safe to kind of come onto the market. So, you know, about 70% of my patients received the vaccine in December, January, February. But by March, I was uncomfortable. And in fact, I distinctly remember in March, we were at about 1,600 deaths. And the CDC put on their website that CDC and FDA doctors had reviewed all the deaths and none of them were related to the vaccine. Now looking backwards, and I've made presentations for officials in Washington on this, the mortality signal of concern emerged in our program January 22nd. And on January 22nd, we hit 186 deaths. Now, for a program this size, anything that would get past about 150 deaths would be an alarm signal. We hit that 186 deaths with only 27 million Americans vaccinated. And if we would have had the proper committee structures there, a data safety monitoring board and human ethics board, I think would have shut down the program in February based on safety and the risks of death.
I think about the swine flu vaccine. I mean, there were, 50, 51, 55 deaths, and they shut it down. Why wasn't that done this time?
Well, we didn't have, you know, we had no press briefing on safety to Americans. We had no external committees watching over the sponsors. You know, you never assume your sponsors can fairly evaluate the program because they're invested in it. You have to have external bodies. So the structure wasn't there. And the news cycle was just get the vaccine, get the vaccine. There was just never, you know, stop. We're going to review safety here and give Americans some information. In medicine, we use a term called primum non nocere. That means above all, do no harm. If we're going to have a public use product and ask Americans to use that product, boy, it better be safe. And you're right. Swine flu, 1976. The program was shut down at 25 deaths. It turned out, I think it went up to 53 after the shutdown. There was 500 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome. We have other vaccines. You know, the estimates are we probably have 70 or so vaccines on the market. And because Americans take vaccines, including myself, I've had a flu shot and shingle shot this year. We've all had vaccines maybe 500,000 shots given per year. We know that the total number of deaths is around 150 that get reported into VAERS. And it's not in any temporal relationship to the administration of the shot. This is kind of ambiently reported in the database. We know, I'll give you an example. Americans know college kids go off and they are asked to get the meningococcal vaccine. You know, probably get 20 million college kids get the meningococcal vaccine, zero deaths. The expectation is college kids taking a vaccine, the standard in the United States, zero deaths. So here we are with COVID-19. It's January 22nd. We have 186 deaths. Kind of nobody's really letting us know this. We get to March, we're at 1,600 deaths, and there's a mention, oh, it's just not related to the vaccine. And now we go fully forward today. What the CDC is telling us is there are 11,000 deaths after the vaccine, including U.S. and some non-U.S. numbers that contribute to that with Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J. Now, Pfizer and Moderna are 90% of the shots, so obviously they occupy 90% of the deaths. And so VAERS, because it's an open database, is amenable to research. And so since our government was not giving us safety reports, no data safety monitoring board, no reports whatsoever, we were just told there was a talking point. It said safe and effective, take the vaccine. people started saying, wait a minute, you know, 11,000 deaths, safe and effective? And it wasn't just deaths. I mean, we had hospitalizations piling up, tens of thousands of hospitalizations, ER visits, clinic visits, other reports coming in. There was some side-tracked issues of specialty focus. So for instance, it was shown with Pfizer Moderna heart inflammation in young people called myocarditis. Well, the CDC had a review in June on this with a couple hundred cases. 90% of the kids were hospitalized. They had chest pain and EKG changes, blood enzyme, troponin level elevations, heart pumping muscle function reduced by imaging. You know, to admit a kid to the hospital in their teenage or young 20s, it takes a lot to do that, honestly. So there was great concern with those 200 kids. We're at 2,800 cases of myocarditis. Johnson & Johnson was paused for a review because of blood clots. Blood clots in women in the brain called cavernous venous thrombosis. It was paused, but there wasn't any change in dose. There wasn't any risk mitigation. And so the FDA just put out warnings saying, listen, we got myocarditis in Pfizer Moderna. We have blood clots in J&J in women ages 18 to 48. And we have additionally what's called Guillain-Barré syndrome or ascending paralysis in J&J. The FDA kind of said these things are out here, and we keep plotting forward. So two critical analyses have been done in the last 4 weeks Americans should know about. One by McLachlan and colleagues out of London, and the other one by Rose from Israel. And this is what they've concluded based on their analysis of VAERS. That 50% of these deaths occur within 48 hours of getting the shot. 50%. 80% of the deaths occur in a week. The majority of people are well enough to walk into a vaccine center and they have a fatal outcome. When we look at what else could have caused the death, the answer is 86% of the time, nothing else could have caused the death. It looks like the vaccine was the cause of death. We had in the last week, I know it's not scientific, but it's out there, there was a survey done on Twitter asking, does anybody know somebody who's died after taking the vaccine? About 10,000 people responded. You know what the answer was? 12% of people said, yeah, I know somebody who died after taking the vaccine. So we've heard from our agencies, you know, about vaccine hesitancy. We don't want to have any interview like this that would cause vaccine hesitancy. Well, when people see others in their circle, their family members, their church, their friends dying after the vaccine, that type of organic vaccine hesitancy, you can't stop that. And Americans at this point in time are enormously reluctant to take the vaccine. We know the vaccine rates in the United States started to drop April 8th. And they dropped and they dropped and they dropped and they dropped. Now, we've gone months where the vaccine rates are incredibly low. Nobody wants to take the vaccine. And we've seen an incredible violation of human ethics. No one for an investigational product under any circumstances should receive any pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal for not participating in research. You know what we're seeing? We're seeing million-dollar raffles. Here, take the vaccine and you could be in a raffle for $1 million. Free college tuition, giant bonuses if you would be a flight attendant, etc. And it didn't stop there. Again, people didn't sign up for these. They said, wait a minute, I don't want to die with the vaccine. Then came mandates saying, listen, if you don't take the vaccine, you're going to lose your job. And the first kind of employer to really get out there and do that was Houston Methodist. And they got Houston Methodist employees up to 98% vaccinated. There has never been a hospital outbreak of COVID-19. We've never had scores of doctors and nurses get it. It's never happened. We have actually never had a dental clinic outbreak. They've been in people's mouths all year long, no outbreaks of COVID-19. But why healthcare personnel were really isolated, the thought is, well, you could get it or you could give it or, quote, you need to be protected. Well, sure enough, 98% vaccinated. The people who couldn't get, a lot of people were, you know, young women who were pregnant, childbearing. They were never tested in the clinical trials. We had no idea if it was safe or not in pregnant women. We know it couldn't benefit young people. Most of them are young people. In the end, they got fired. They lost their job. Didn't stop there. What we've had now in the last few weeks is a wave of announcements of people, they must take mandatory vaccines. About 9% of colleges have been told, take the vaccine or don't show up to campus. Now, these are kids who are fully engaged in college. They've paid their tuition. They're students in good standing. This is an investigational vaccine. And we know that people under age 30 have an incredibly good prognosis, like a mild case of the sniffles. Even Linus Pauling has said, don't try to vaccinate against the common cold. It's just going to cause trouble. And to have the vaccine be a menace over kids who just want to return to college is unconscionable. And you've seen fracturing of ideas on this. The state of Ohio said, no, don't do it. No college in Ohio can do this until we know more, or they're safe or approved. Texas, we had an executive order, said no state institution. So Texas will only have four small colleges that have done it. But sadly, 9% of colleges, some big ones across the country, have said we're going to do it. And it doesn't stop there. Some high schools have said we're going to have mandates. LA Independent School District, a huge one. And then people have stepped up and said, listen, kids, even at a younger age, they have no opportunity for benefit. They only have an opportunity for harm. The parents were outraged. And finally, they got lawyers and other people, and LA Independent School District backed down. So what Americans should know is when you see a fracturing of policy, when you see things that seem like it's an overreach, I think everybody should be alarmed.
It's very sobering. And I'm, of course, talking to you from New York City. Our mayor, of course, has just announced that we will be compelled to get a key to the city, quote unquote, in order to go to restaurants or attend public events.
We know that this is what's going to turn the tide. And we also know that people are going to get a really clear message. If you want to participate in our society fully, you got to get vaccinated. You got to get vaccinated. It's time.
I've heard you mention this before. If you could just run down some of the adverse events that you personally have seen among the vaccinated.
Well, I can tell you, I've reviewed the literature pretty carefully on this, and the best paper is by Rose et al. It's published in the American Journal of Public Health Policy and Law, and in VAERS, of the non-fatal injuries, vaccine injuries, they tend to occur in younger people. And, you know, it'd be my theory, it's just a theory, that maybe younger people, younger cells take up more of the genetic material. We know the genetic material is taken up into cells in the body, it's distributed all in the body, and then the spike protein is produced inside human cells. That's very abnormal. And when the spike protein comes on the cell surface of cells, the body attacks it. The body recognizes it foreign. And then it breaks free and it circulates in the bloodstream for about 2 weeks. That's been shown by Ogata and colleagues from Harvard. So that's disturbing that a dangerous protein that we know by itself is dangerous, it damages blood vessels and causes blood clotting, is allowed to kind of race free in the body for 2 weeks. Now, the second injection of the messenger RNA vaccines tends to dampen down that measurable spike protein, but we don't know how long it stays in the body. There are estimates now that it may stay in the body for months. So you can imagine getting an implant of genetic material that stays in the body for a prolonged period of time and produces an abnormal spike protein that the body knows is abnormal. It's bound to cause inflammation, scarring, damage in the human body, in vital organs over time. We know that these lipid nanoparticles can go up into the brain. They can go into the adrenal glands, the ovaries, other endocrine organs, and then dump the genetic payload into these kind of really sensitive tissues, dump a genetic payload into the heart and this issue of myocarditis, the skeletal muscles, the nerves. So in this analysis by Rose and colleagues, based on what's known of this dangerous mechanism of action, sure enough, the injuries are in four major organ systems, the heart, the brain, the immunologic system, and the hematologic system. And these injuries have led to, I think we're at a total now of over 100,000 hospitalizations, ER visits, and clinic visits. That is giant. We're approaching 500,000 certified injuries by the CDC. 500,000, that's a whole new disease category. So what I've seen in my practice is an array of neurologic syndromes. Cerebellar syndrome, cerebral syndromes. It almost seems like wherever this scattergram of genetic material goes, it can damage blindness, paralysis, difficulty swallowing. The neurologic syndromes were really highlighted in a press briefing by Senator Johnson, the first vaccine injury press briefing, where people came forward. They were in the original randomized trials, and they said, you know, I signed up for this. I was a very pro-vaccine. I wanted to be involved. And in fact, they were involved in the clinical trials, and it was months later where something started to go wrong in the body and couldn't walk, seizures, blindness, paralysis, etc. It was really just horrifying to see.
Over the past 5 months, Maddie has been to the ER 9 times and has been hospitalized 3 times for a total of 2 months. She was totally fine. Before this, she did the right thing trying to help everybody else, and they're not helping her.
In the end, these participants say they just want others to know what they went through.
I'm not advocating anything other than to listen to these people, to see them, and take them seriously.
We know, and I've seen these neurologic centers in my practice. Headaches is another one. Another one is ringing in the ears. I have a physician colleague who said, you know, he took one of the vaccines back in January. It's incessant ringing in the ears. It just is like, what a price to pay, because this will not go away. That's on the neurologic side. The cardiac side, I've mentioned myocarditis. We don't know what the outcome is going to be there. I can tell you this much. In my practice, of course, people seek me out, and I'm concerned about vaccine safety, and they'll bring me a young child who has myocarditis. I'll dutifully examine them, review the troponins, all the data. I'll enter it in VAERS. I've entered it, you know, pinpoint. Where was the hospitalization? What did the EKG show? Pinpoint all the lab results. It's under threat of imprisonment or federal fines if I lie on the form. So I'm telling you, what's in VAERS is done. We know 80% of what's in VAERS is reported by doctors and nurses who think the vaccine caused it. You know, this case I'm talking about, he took the vaccine, 2 days later, boom, he's got heart inflammation, and it's serious. I fill this all out, and I can tell you 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from a CDC officer who reviews everything and verifies everything. So when I'm telling you the CDC has verified 2,800 cases of myocarditis, that's not fake. That's real. We have 2,800 young people who had no benefit from the vaccine. Now they've got heart injury. About 25% of them from the CDC review of this have reduced heart pumping function. They're on heart failure medications. My patient's on a heart failure medication. He's trying to return to school. We don't know if he's going to develop heart failure. There's been one case that's gone all the way to a heart transplant, and unfortunately, she passed away. This is basically a catastrophe in real time. These are people who have no opportunity to benefit from the vaccine. Many of them are already immune. They actually already have had COVID. They can't get it a second time. They're getting loaded with this genetic material, and it's ravaging the body. On the immunologic side, that's less well defined, but there's an array of various immunologic syndromes. I was made aware of somebody, again, in my circle with an unbelievable immune system rash. And she's gone from ER and dermatologist and other, and it is a relentless, painful rash as one manifestation. There's a new disease in the blood system category called vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpura. It's been published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It tends to occur with AstraZeneca and with J&J, but this is a blood disorder where the platelet count goes very low. Patients develop anemia. They start getting bruising and clotting at the same time. Again, this is all unnecessary. The only way to avoid this array of injuries and the risk of death is to say no to the vaccine. And that's really where we are right now. Americans are saying, listen, enough's enough. The federal agencies have not come clean with us on any type of independent safety report without any frequency. I mean, we're 7 months into this, and we're told on TV, safe and effective, take the vaccine. In fact, it's even worse than that. In our place of employment, we're told, take the vaccine or lose your job. In New York, you're saying, you've been told, take the vaccine or you can't ride a subway, I guess. I mean, it is the tension in America right now is palpable. And I think that the latest shoe to drop is now a realization that the vaccines don't work fully and people are getting COVID anyway.
I got yelled at by my mother's cardiologist when I described the shot as a gene therapy. Is that correct to say if it's having this long-term effect? We've seen Dr. Bridle come out and say, you know, I was a part of developing this and we made a huge mistake because, you know, we've created something that, you know, teaches the cell to create the spike protein and the spike protein is the problem.
What has been discovered by scientific community is the spike protein on its own is almost entirely responsible for the damage to the cardiovascular system if it gets into circulation. Indeed, if you inject the purified spike protein into the blood of research animals, they get all kinds of damage to the cardiovascular system, and it can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause damage to the brain.
Just assuming among, you know, kind of honest people of goodwill who were involved in this, what could they have been thinking in developing an mRNA concoction that teaches the cell to make the very thing that seems to be involved in all of the problems? What was the logic in that to begin with? And then if you could, you know, speak to what you actually think this is all about.
You know, if we were to just try to put the most positive light on this, the developers could have been thinking that a small enough dose in the arm would just stay in the arm, cause enough local cells to take up the genetic material, temporarily express the spike protein, and get enough of an immunity. I think if you would have told anybody last fall that these particles were going to go everywhere in the body, the brain, the heart, ovaries, adrenal glands, that they were going to produce really a large quantity of spike protein that's measurable in blood. I mean, you actually have to produce a lot to do that. And that spike protein itself is independently dangerous. All this became knowledge that converged over the last year. I think any vaccine developer would say, you know what, this is sounding pretty scary, pretty dangerous. Let's go ahead and put the brakes on this program. But it got out, and it got out under this rushed Operation Warp Speed. And we had two administrations behind this. We have basically sold academic medicine. Remember, academic medicine was on the sidelines for early treatment. They had been barraged with these inpatients. They were thirsty and prepared to accept and promote the vaccine. Every single major medical group, the American Medical Association, American College of Physicians, every state medical society had vaccine town halls, how to promote vaccine acceptance. There was vaccine hubris in America. I remember back early on in the program, there was even a Saturday Night Live skit where people were dancing around, they took the vax and what have you. You know, the word vaccine is used now more in our vocabulary than I think than any other word outside of pronouns and verb, action verbs, whatever. It is extraordinary that we have vaccine on the mind, but it obviously was a mistake, and things have gotten far out of hand. We're at about half of Americans have taken the vaccine. Half the Americans haven't taken the vaccine, and you know what? They don't want it. They've expressed their will. They don't want it. We know in Japan, it's fewer than 20%. Japanese are very interesting. They held back on this. They knew the Olympics were coming. They saw this, and they said, this doesn't look good. They've really restricted their use. I was early on in the program in messaging saying, listen, high-risk patients, seniors, nursing home workers, I think we could have gotten out of it with 5, 10, maybe 15 million, maybe 20 million people vaccinated. Stop there. Assess safety. Let's do a deep dive. Is it working? Is it not? I never would have suggested at all that someone who's COVID recovered, who has a negligible chance of ever getting COVID, that person should never get a vaccine. In fact, we have three papers, Kammer, Mathudius, and Raw, that have showed that patients get more severe reactions and damage when they take the COVID-19, when they've previously had COVID. It makes sense. You don't want to re-rev up this immune system response in the body. Bad news. It would never do it. I never, under any circumstances, would ever advise or be a party to a pregnant woman or a woman of childbearing potential to get the vaccine. Why? We never inject substances in a pregnant woman's body that are potentially dangerous. We know the spike protein is more than potentially dangerous. It's flat out lethal. And in a woman, you know, the blood system and the blood flow to the placenta is everything. We would never inject a substance in the body that creates something like the spike protein that damages blood vessels and causes blood clotting. We never would do that. In women, we only allow inactivated flu, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. That's it. Only. Period. And we actually have classes in pregnancy, class A, B, and C, what have you, that about allowable drugs. And drugs are considered dangerous until proven safe. Dangerous to proven safe. This has a dangerous mechanism of action. And we have a recent publication in TrialSite News where we had to get this out there. We said, listen, this is pregnancy category X, everybody. No use. None. Zero. And you know, as we sit here today, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology tells women, take the vaccine. Medical care is off its rockers. And I can tell you, when doctors come out of their trance, they are in a vaccine trance right now. They are in a different zone. Doctors, when I look them in the eyes, they look cloudy. They look foggy, like they know something's wrong. They know they're doing something wrong. They're kind of disturbed, but they can't seem to come out of their trance. Other doctors, like me, they can see it very clearly. We would never, you give me a vial of a dangerous substance and say, inject it into a pregnant woman. I won't do it. I took an oath. I swore a Hippocratic oath as a doctor. I would never do that. How about a woman of childbearing potential? Do these drugs cause birth defects or not? Well, we don't know. Wouldn't a pregnant woman or wouldn't a woman who's trying to conceive be concerned about a product which we now know hyperconcentrates in the ovaries? So what happened is the Japanese were suspicious. they said, wait a minute, where do these particles go? And, you know, I think the regulatory discussion is, well, they just stay in the arm. Japanese said, wait a minute, show us. And so they made Pfizer do a biodistribution study. Pfizer injected lipid nanoparticles, not the RNA, but the lipid nanoparticles in animals, and used a radio tracer and showed where it went in the body. And sure enough, they go into all the organs, and then they wash out. But the one organ where it continues to rise and concentrate is the ovaries. And that information was gained from a Freedom of Information Act from Canada, Dr. Byron Bridle, from the Japanese regulatory authorities. And that's when the news broke that the vaccines hyperconcentrate the lipid nanoparticles in the ovaries. Separately, the European Medical Association, EMA, asked Moderna, wait a minute, do these actually influence fertility? And Moderna was asked to produce a fertility study in animals. And sure enough, Moderna reduced fertility in animals. Now, the threshold to kill the program was a 25% reduction in fertility in animals. It's hard to judge because the animals, you know, they fornicate, and it's hard to know, you know, to judge it. But the number they came up with was 16% reduction in fertility. So when we put this together, and if you were to ask me, Dr. McCullough, in a young woman, is it possible that these vaccines could actually reduce fertility? I'm telling you, I think it's biologically plausible that, in fact, that could happen. One of the things we noticed in the vaccine program is women noticed their periods changing. They noticed, boy, my menstruation changes. There have been reports of postmenopausal women. I've received these reports starting to have vaginal bleeding. So it gave an idea that, wait a minute, these are actually going to the ovaries. So I think Americans and people worldwide should be, I've been pinpoint with my citations, by the way, and I'm very concerned about information and misinformation and being labeled. What I'm giving you on this video is complete and total citable, verifiable, fact-checkable information. And this information here is very disturbing regarding potential impact on fertility.
The doctors you're talking to and the doctors that I've run into in my daily life or my friends or in my family, they're in the trance that you describe. But what about whoever's driving this? Is there any benign explanation for what they are doing? Or what is the possible malign explanation? I mean, we're seeing this is a global program. I mean, you've described some of the other vaccines as perhaps not as dangerous in effect, but, you know, the entire world shut down, all the same language was used, the same propaganda campaign seemed to be simultaneously rolled out everywhere. So what do you think is going on to the extent that you feel comfortable talking about? I know I'm asking you to speculate.
Well, you mentioned a couple of things. A, it's global, which is true, very global. We're at less than 20% of the world has taken a vaccine, fortunately. We know that in places outside the United States, things are much worse. You know, we've seen reports from Indonesia, people being told they can't get government checks or receive health care. In Italy, it's been announced you can't get care in a clinic and hospital. In Australia, people are in endless lockdowns despite hardly any cases of COVID-19. And then we hear things that are just like you can't make this up. United Kingdom. They have hundreds of thousands of patients reported in the UK weekly report that comes out, the variant report. And of the Delta variant, which is now the predominant variant, 42% of individuals are fully vaccinated. Unfortunately, Delta, very low mortality. You know, it's easier virus to treat and manage. But of the patients who died with Delta in the UK, 65% fully vaccinated.
There was quite a lot of good news about COVID-19 recently, but some people have been pointing towards quite a scary statistic, certainly scary on the surface. And it comes in this table from Public Health England, looking at who's got the Delta variant and what's happened to them later on. And I'll just circle it. You can see it there. Look, of those who've received two doses of the vaccination, 224 died. In fact, actually, if you look across those who have been vaccinated, one or two doses, the majority of those deaths were people who were vaccinated, which raises a question. Are the vaccines working? What's going wrong here?
There was an outbreak in Finland. In Finland, and this is published in the literature, I believe it's Hetti Makin, it's a Finnish name, who published it, of patients in like a secondary hospital, almost like a nursing home, and workers. And the patients, of the 24 patients who got COVID-19, 18 of them were fully vaccinated. So we have reports from multiple places in the world. It looks like the vaccines don't work. We had a wedding in Houston where people were carefully tested. They were all vaccinated. We had a Democratic plane flight from Texas to Washington, all vaccinated. And then we had a British naval vessel, 3,700 young men, all vaccinated. All three of these events, there were outbreaks of COVID-19. And the Houston wedding was interesting. It was all presumed to be Delta, but that, there's a paper by Fahrenholt and colleagues that tested this Houston wedding. And in fact, it was the Delta variant. And in fact, the vaccinated people acquired it and they passed it to other people. So, you know, this is of great concern. The Finnish nursing home outbreak, same thing. So the CDC in July 30th published in their own journal called MMWR a report of outbreaks in Barnstable County, Massachusetts. And what they reported is they reported around 300 to 400 cases. Two-thirds of individuals were fully vaccinated. So Americans are scratching their head. They're aware of this, that, wait a minute, you know, large numbers of people vaccinated are getting COVID-19. How in the world is this talking point being generated that this is a crisis of the unvaccinated, that this is the unvaccinated are accounting for 99% of cases? Have you noticed this talking point? It's 99. It's not 100%, but it's not. How is it 99 across the board? Well, the genesis of this was in May 1st of this year, the CDC had already acquired 10,000 bona fide vaccine failure cases. They were fully vaccinated. They had 10,000. Over that period of time, by the way, of those who were naturally immune, they didn't have a single case. So the natural immunity was perfect, but the vaccine immunity looked like it was failing pretty substantially up until May 1st, and the CDC said, no more. We're not going to report any more of this, and we're only going to report COVID-19 in the unvaccinated or as if they're unvaccinated. I'm not even sure the CDC knows the vaccination status, honestly. So I think they are just generically saying they created this. It's called asymmetric reporting, and they're doing it in the open. This is all announced. This is for us to figure out. You can go on the CDC website, and you can track every single thing I'm saying. This is in the open. It is asymmetric reporting to say it's a crisis of the unvaccinated at this pivot point where now employers are coming in with this kind of menacing vaccine set of mandates to force the vaccine on people. And Americans aren't fooled. I mean, it's happening in circles. This morning, somebody in my wife's extended family, she just had Pfizer 2 months ago. She's got full-blown COVID. And thankfully, she's getting the proper medications. I mean, we're seeing this in our practice. I can tell you, as a general rule, Senator Bob Hall last week in Texas made a bunch of calls to doctors and said, what are you really seeing? Boots on the ground, your clinic and in the hospital. The answer is probably 50-50 or 60-40. I think overall probably is more unvaccinated than vaccinated in the United States because we've got slightly more people unvaccinated in the United States. But it doesn't appear as if the vaccines are sufficiently protective. It's certainly not compelling that the vaccines are working. Now, there's been a recent paper, it's in preprint, from Israel that has looked at duration. So is the vaccine losing its effect over time? And that paper does suggest after about 6 months, there's lesser degrees of protection. There was a paper from Denmark in nursing home work. So nursing home workers had about 90% vaccine efficacy. It's hard to compute this outside of a randomized trial because you don't know who's exposed and who's not. But let's take it at face value, 90% vaccine efficacy in the nursing home workers, but it was only 60% in the nursing home residents because they were older and sicker. So as we sit here today, older and sicker people who have more medical problems, who need the most protection, they're the ones who are protected the least, okay? And so the great concern I have right now as a doctor is my patients who are older and sicker who have taken the vaccine, that they're not fully protected.
I want to get back to what you think is behind everything, but let me just stick with the Delta variant for a second. So first of all, how do we know that so many of these cases are the Delta variant? You know, are they sequencing them like on the spot? Are we really sure that that's, you know, are they doing the complete genome? And then Dr. Yeadon, for instance, has said that the Delta variant is, say, 99.7% the same as, you know, the Alpha variant, as opposed to, say, SARS-CoV-1, which is 80% similar. So how does it that this variant is allegedly more dangerous for kids?
Well, let's try to unravel that. Actually, you're talking about unpacking. We need to unpack that. Two important analyses, one by Neeson and one by Venkata Krishnan out of Boston and Mayo Clinic, have a giant database of genomes. So a lot of people who have had full genomic testing of infection. And what they've shown is that the unvaccinated have a much greater diversity of strains. And that's what the way it was in the United States. We had a greater diversity of strains before the vaccines. And the CDC, roughly once a week, does a report on the different variations or strains. And it's done in the local departments of community health, and they do have the ability to do full sequencing, okay? And so, round about January timeframe, let's say we had 14 different strains. Back in the fall, maybe even a few more. And so there's the alpha and the beta and lambda. I won't bother you with it, but there's kind of an array of strains. That's what it is. That's what we have when there's nothing else. It's just the human population. But once we get, and the paper by Neeson is important, once we get to more than 25% vaccinated rate, that puts on what's called a non-lethal evolutionary pressure on the population. And then all the strains can't equally survive, and one strain finds a way to get past the vaccine, and that strain becomes the dominant strain. So a couple months ago in the United States, Delta, which has always been there, we've always had Delta. Delta is the most mutated form of the virus. It's got 7 mutations in the spike protein, and so the conformation of the spike proteins change. Delta was maybe 2% a couple months ago. The last report the CDC put out, 83% Delta. I was on a call this week at Departments of Community Health in Texas, probably 100% Delta. So we can assume right now that what we're seeing, this latest outbreak, that it's basically Delta. Delta in the test tube is slightly more infectious than Alpha and Beta, but not much. The infectivity, when someone announces it's more infectious, that's actually from a test tube study of how much the virus, when you sprinkle it on a cell, how much does it actually invade the cell. So it's not a good representation in populations. What determines how much things spread in population is the amount of natural immunity. If you have a lot of natural immunity, it's not going to spread very far. So what we can see in all the sources of data, fortunately, Delta appears to be the mildest of all the variants. It has the lowest overall hospitalization and mortality. And today, even though we're in the middle of an outbreak, do you know that the number of new hospitalizations, as an example, is no different than what it was in April? And America seems to be kind of in a panic right now, but honestly, in August, it's no worse than it was in April. We are having a rise. I've been on national TV to try to help America understand the data. We are going to have a rise, and it's going to go down. I don't think it's going to be as high as what we saw in December, but it's going to be up there and go down. United Kingdom is already on the other side of the curve. I think Israel is probably getting very close to being on the other side of the curve. America will get through this Delta outbreak and on the way down. But what's contributing to Delta this time is the vaccinated. The vaccinated are actually getting Delta. They're passing it to others, and they're contributing to this outbreak. So the idea of a passport or a mandate is foolhardy. You can imagine everybody enjoying their privileged passport, coughing and passing Delta on each other in subways and restaurants in New York. You can imagine how ludicrous this is. Americans know the vaccines are failing in terms of controlling COVID-19, and we know there's a fracture now. There's a fracture on boosters. So one of the manufacturers said, well, we got to hurry up and do a booster. And what I know about the boosters right now is they're not adjusting the vaccine to Delta. It's going to be just the same vaccine. The vaccine is coded to the wild-type spike protein. The wild spike protein is extinct. That's gone. So a booster is just going to be more of the same. And as we sit here today, it'd be my judgment, my opinion, that a booster would not cover the problem, which is now a mutant virus that has antigenic escape. The Venkata Krishnan paper showed that in fact, it's sufficient change in the spike protein. The antibodies can't properly neutralize it. That's how it's getting past, at least in some people. That's how it's happening. So it's foolhardy right now to think of any place would actually mandate the vaccine against the virus that it's not even protecting against, number one, and then to incur all the safety hazards that we've talked about. So we're coming to a real pressure point in America. The tension, you can cut it with a knife right now. People are sending emails. They're having emergency teleconferences. We just had a great presentation of Truth for Health, which is a giant collaboration between scientists and religious leaders to say, listen, we got to stop here. It'd be very, very reasonable right now to halt the program or just restrict it to someone who wants to volunteer for it in some special circumstance. But in no way, shape, and form should we mandate a vaccine that doesn't work sufficiently to even do much from a public health perspective and has great concerns over safety. It's probably one of the biggest mistakes that I've ever seen go. I mean, this whole pandemic's been a series of mistakes. But right now, we're at this pressure point. And I think America, talking to people in my circles, they're willing right now to take a time out. They're saying, listen, if I've got to take a year out of college, I'll do it. If I have to walk off the job and take a sabbatical, I'll figure it out. But the only way to stay healthy right now is to stay away from this vaccine. If they get COVID-19, get to one of these treatment networks and get natural immunity on the other side. Delta is very easy to treat. Now, I've got some serious cases right now in my advisor panel that I'm trying to help doctors and help patients directly. I'm not saying it's a cakewalk. In fact, we've been aware of just a deadly case that happened in Central Texas, and it really touched somebody close to us. I don't want to give a false sense that this is a joke here, that Delta is serious, but patients need early treatment. The vaccines don't seem to be working.
From an unscientific, but say a propaganda analysis point of view, the variants, and I guess Lambda is on the horizon, you're saying that the variants are already all out there. They just kind of come to prominence for various, you know, evolutionary reasons, or as you say, the pressure from the vaccine. The variants seem like part of an extended propaganda or sales rollout, if you will, for the booster. I mean, it seems like, you know, in that leaked document that we saw that the Washington Post put out, you know, from CDC, it's like, you know, public demands booster. You know, it's like as if that demand were already kind of emerging from the public as opposed to coming from the health authorities. So what's your sense of that? Couldn't they just conceivably, if the idea is to get a needle in every arm, right? I mean, that's the kind of the phrase. Couldn't they just, with a kind of perpetual motion, just keep putting out variant scares and then suggesting that we must have boosters and that, you know, your health pass that you got with the original vaccine isn't good enough. Now you need the booster pass. I mean, isn't that the road that we're heading down?
Well, I think the variants are very real. If we go back, so Alpha is the UK variant, Beta is South African. Remember, the South African is not well covered by J&J AstraZeneca. Even the original study, South Africa, only 50% coverage. So we'd expect a lot of vaccine failures with those vaccines out of the Beta variant. We have Gamma in Brazil. Gamma is actually the worst one. I think Gamma is the strongest one. The Brazilians have been fighting Gamma for the most recent time. We have Delta. That came out of India because in pockets of India, they were actually vaccinating with the Sinovac more. In Maharashtra, even though India is a huge country, but certain pockets they had pretty highly vaccinated. Delta arose out of there. And so Delta is just, you know, went to UK and now Delta is here. And now out of Peru is Lambda. And Lambda, they actually got to about 60% vaccinated again with Sinovac. Lambda came out of it, and a very good analysis from Arcevedo and colleagues out of Chile studying the Peruvian outbreak of Lambda really shows the vaccines are causing this. The vaccines are causing these strains to arise. Now out of California, we have the Epsilon variant, which we think because of pressure out there with Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J. If we keep this up with vaccination, it's going to be one variant after another. This is going to be the great concern. And what some experts have told us is, fortunately with Delta, it's milder. What if we get a more serious one? What if we get one that can escape the vaccine but actually injure Americans and injure the body more? Now we're in trouble. Now we've created a monster. And this can happen with antibiotics. You know, if we put everybody on the same antibiotic, we grow up a superbug, resistant, you know, this resistant staph, methicillin-resistant staph, for instance. This is, we're playing with fire here with this mass vaccination. Remember, for the pneumococcal vaccine, it's just the seniors. Shingles, it's just limited. Hepatitis B, you know, we have an approach that's targeted. Now, when a illness is eradicated and we want to keep not a single case, we give childhood vaccines. So for instance, polio and things like that, smallpox, when something is eradicated. But in this case, this is far from being eradicated. We have all kinds of people with COVID-19 all over. And this idea that we're going to vaccinate right into a pandemic, we had a lot of people warn us about this, say, don't do this. We're going to make it worse. And I got to tell you, my interpretation as an internist and cardiologist, I'm a trained epidemiologist, I've literally have done a year of COVID, intense COVID research and training. I am telling you, I think this Delta outbreak that we have right now is the product of mass vaccination. If we didn't have the vaccine, we would have been better off. We had already treated this down to a very acceptable level. Now, the Nissen paper says that it's a good thing to vaccinate. That, in fact, the Nissen paper's conclusion is that the non-vaccinated are the genesis, You know, they have this array of genetic diversity. So the non-vaccinated are the originating pool of variants, and that's a bad thing. And my conclusion is just the opposite, is that when you get to more than 25% vaccinated, now you let kind of natural variation, you allow one to become forward and be super dominant. And I tell you, if we got Delta right now, it's super dominant. The best forecast is that Delta is so super dominant, but so manageable, it completely burns out and we're done. We're done. But what we understand with flu is flu doesn't have this enormous mutation pressure. Flu has what's called antigenic drift. And antigenic drift is just a slight methodical change in two antigens, neuraminidase and hemagglutinin. And so with flu, each year we have time to adjust. We say, oh, what's the most common pattern? Okay, the flu vaccine is adjusted for each year. We don't have this type of time. This thing is like a runaway freight train of mass vaccination, mutant strain, and you're right. And it just, is it going to be one after another? Americans and people across the world are being fatigued. Variants are absolutely no reason to keep vaccinating. In fact, the vaccination is looking like it's going to make it worse.
So I got to ask you again, doctor, because I've heard you say it before, and tell me if you're not comfortable, we can cut it out or forget about it. I want to make the most effective video possible and the least subject to preemptive censorship. What's your sense of this? I mean, could it be anything other than what you described in previous interviews, a bioweapon of some kind? I mean, in other words, well, first of all, let's just talk about where does the virus come from? I mean, is your sense that this was a lab leak or zoonotic? And what do we think about the readiness? You know, apparently some of the patents for both SARS-CoV-2 and perhaps, some of the vaccine technology have been around forever. So what's your sense? Is this a two-part bioterrorist weapon, as you've described? And what's the purpose of it?
Well, the word bioterrorism or bioweapon, those aren't my words. They're actually being heavily investigated. Senator Rand Paul has had the division director of the National Institutes of Allergy and Immunology on the stand multiple times and just saying, listen, what was going on in Wuhan? I think what the general understanding is there was gain-of-function research to make the spike protein more dangerous. There was changes in what's called the furin cleavage joint between the first and second segment of the spike protein that allowed it to kind of dock with the ACE receptor and allowed the virus to get into the body more readily and cause more damage through an enzymatic cleavage of a human enzyme called furin. So it looked like there was some intentional manipulation, and the manipulation was, in a sense, to make the virus more dangerous. Now, the question is, like, what was behind this? Why would you want to take a coronavirus and make it more dangerous? What medicinal property would that have? What research property would that have? What could be the goal of doing that? So what you're asking is, what's the goal of making coronavirus more dangerous and more infective and lethal in humans? And people can draw their own conclusions regarding this. But it's obviously heavily investigated. I've been careful to try to stay out of speculation on what's behind it. I would tell you that I refer the viewers to Peter Bragan's book that's going to be out shortly. The full manuscript's available if you purchase the book now. It's called COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey. He's now got 2,000 citations of what went on in the lab, who was behind it, who was funded, who are the American participants, how was this planned out ahead of time. I know that Tucker Carlson, he reached out to Nicholas Wade. He had him a show. Listen, let's go over this. Whitney Webb. There's a whole host of investigative reporters. All I can tell you, it is enormously complex. The more I hear about this, the more the different numbers of stakeholders, the patents, and the connectivity here is enormous. What I am struck with is how people in their minds can come up with the same conclusion. How can hospital administrators in their mind come up with the conclusion that they should mass vaccinate their employees? How did that get in their mind? The CDC is not asking for it. The CDC and the FDA say it's voluntary. Everyone's saying it's voluntary. How does the human mind say, okay, we see this happening. It looks like the vaccines are failing. The safety data doesn't look good at all. Let's mass vaccinate people. How does that decision get in the mind of executives to roll that down to their employees and the employees respond in sheer terror. What is the psychology of that? What's in the minds of leaders in New York to say, okay, we got these vaccines, it looks like they're failing, we're in an outbreak of Delta, the safety data look not good at all. We haven't had a single safety report yet. Let's ask everybody in New York to just take the vaccine in order to go to a restaurant. That is the question. What is in the minds of people? What is in the minds of a doctor to tell a pregnant woman to take a vaccine like this? I think the best way to characterize it, it's a dysturbia. It is maybe a group neurosis. It is something that's come over the minds of people all over the world. And I tell you, whatever's going on is going on in the tiniest island of the Philippines and Indonesia, the smallest little village in Africa and South America. It's all the same. It's come over the entire world. And people like you and me, we're looking at this saying, we're shaking our head like, how can this be happening? So some people's eyes are completely clear. They can see this. It's just so readily apparent to us. Like, no, it's just, and other people are just, and when I interact with them, they look like they are cloudy. They look like somehow they're disturbed, but they really can't articulate it. And to this day, I haven't had a single doctor. Now, I traveled the world. I lectured the world. I've lectured at the New York Academy of Sciences. I've lectured and spoken. I presented before the Congressional Oversight Panel for the NIH. I engage with people my entire career. When I engage with a colleague on this, the colleagues, they look like they're confused. We can't even talk about early treatment. There may be one or two interchanges, and they just kind of disappear. On the vaccine, I met a young doctor who trained under me the other day. I saw him out in the neighborhood. We started talking. I said, I'm kind of disturbed about what I'm seeing. He goes, well, COVID-19 is a bad disease. A lot of people died. What do you think? We got to take the vaccine. I did a TV show with Dr. Drew. Everybody knows Dr. Drew, the handsome silver-haired gentleman on TV. And we talked about this. And I said, Dr. Drew, what's going on? He goes, I think the American public was prepared for this. The American public had seen so much fear, isolation, hospitalization, and death that they were prepared. They were prepared to take mass casualties an injury with the vaccine, that the American public was prepared for this. That's his psychological theory. I'm aghast.
So how do we break through the trance? I mean, how do we deal with, whatever this psychological preparation that's been happening, this propaganda that's prepared the way, clearly amongst, my old comrades on the left, it had to do with, the fact that Trump said hydroxychloroquine or Trump said it's not so bad or whatever. So they were the subject of Trump derangement syndrome. But, and some variant of this has been in place all over the world. But how do we reach people now? What have you found effective? Have you ever managed to break through to a colleague? Have you ever managed to break through to just a person on the street? Like, what does it? What is successful?
I have to tell you, I've spent time with psychologists. I've had psychologists reach out to me saying, listen, something's really gone wrong in the United States. People have used the analogy, this is like Nazi Germany, where something comes over people's minds. People have asked, how did people in Japan come into the same mindset on Nazism as those in Germany? They didn't have Twitter. They didn't have the internet. They weren't talking to each other. How does the same mindset settle on people all over the world? What happened during World War II in this axis of evil, it seems like it's happened across the world, but it's settled on something. It's settled on COVID-19. It clearly has principles of fear, isolation, suffering, hospitalization, and death. That's a core principle. And then all roads lead to the vaccine. I think that's clear all over the world. The only answer is the vaccine. And with Nazism, obviously it took years, but people came out of their trance and they were horrified at what they did. They said, oh my gosh, how could we think this way? And I think doctors will come out of their trance. They're going to look at this and, we're going to tell historically the thing. Listen, we're coming up on thousands of Americans have died within a couple of days of the vaccine. How could we have promoted this? At some point in time, this will be a point of discussion. And right now, people, it's not just doctors. We're talking nurses, mid-level providers, company executives. And, you know, fortunately, I think what's happened in America is 50% of Americans have their eyes open. And they're saying, we don't want it. We don't want the vaccine. And I tell you, there's not a single person at any hospital or health system that I've talked to that thinks that they should have a vaccine mandate. Nobody. I don't know a single person in New York who's messaged me that says, wow, I really want to have a passport. So these things that are coming down seem to be originating from very few people. And they are opposed by large numbers. So this is also a very interesting thing. Very few people, but opposed by large numbers. The other thing that's interesting is there appears to be almost a set of talking points. Now, you use the word propaganda, not me, but I'll use it. Propaganda is false information that's put out in a public manner by people of authority in order to influence something. And I think propaganda does apply here. The other thing that applies is a word called malfeasance. Malfeasance is wrongdoing by those in position of authority. When I told you we started this mass vaccination program with no safety review, no safety committees, and no safety review, that's malfeasance. So when historians will go over this from a scientific regulatory perspective, they're going to say, full stop. This is going to be a course in medical ethics of violation of medical ethics, violation of the Nuremberg Code, the Declaration of Helsinki. We have six cornerstones of medical ethics we rely on in the Office of Human Research Protections. You know, and you know, it's not like doctors have sat by and done nothing. There are physician and nurses petition letters into the FDA saying, stop it, don't approve these, they're not safe. The evidence-based consulting group in the UK, which is the principal consulting, contract consultant to the World Health Organization, has evaluated the yellow card system there. Same thing as what we're seeing here in VAERS. Same thing. They wrote the MHRA, which is the FDA of England, and said, full stop. They are not safe for human use. There was a lead group out of France very early on in March said, stop it. Not safe for use. Stop the vaccine program. We've had a paper by Bruno and colleagues, 57 authors, 17 countries, so basically said, listen, if you can't get safety under control, shut down the program. And on top, it just keeps going. We've had former executives from Gates Foundation, from Pfizer, people involved in the invention of the technology, one by one by one. We've had a Nobel Prize winner, one from France, all crying to the world, stop it. Stop it right now before more people are hurt. It's not working and is causing tremendous damage. So it's the most, in many ways, it's a very interesting time to come be alive. A big part of this is the media. The trusted news service in December was announced. BBC announced it, said, listen, there's only one thing that's going to get through the media is promotion of the vaccine. That's it. That was, I think it was December 10th. Trusted news, people should know this. That means full suppression of any treatment, any early treatment, even EUA antibodies suppressed, and then suppression of anything on vaccine safety. Suppression. And that everyone agreed to do this. YouTube, Twitter, ABC, NBC, everybody agreed. Local news channels. The trusted news service became the rule. So how can anybody get any fair information on what's going on? So the public has basically had an incredible rush to independent podcasts, independent videos. They're on BitChute and Rumble and YouTube the best they can in order to find out what's going on. I mean, people know that there is a propagandized program, and there is, in a sense, a social weaponization of the vaccine. It's socially weaponized. Now, people, there have been doctor commenters that have gone on CNN.
The vaccine is the ticket back to pre-pandemic life. And the window to do that is really narrowing. I mean, you were mentioning, Chris, about how all these states are reopening. They're reopening at 100%. And we have a very narrow window to tie reopening policy to vaccination status. Because otherwise, if everything is reopened, then what's the carrot going to be? How are we going to incentivize people to actually get the vaccine? So that's why I think the CDC and the Biden administration needs to come out a lot bolder and say, if you're vaccinated, you can do all these things. Here are all these freedoms that you have.
It's time to take the vaccine, and your freedoms should be limited to the vaccine. We've heard several CNN anchors saying, listen, you get the vaccine, you get your freedoms back.
Don't get the vaccine, you can't go to the supermarket. Don't have the vaccine, you don't show it, can't go to the ball game. Don't have the vaccine, can't go to work. You don't have the vaccine, can't come here. No shirt, no shoes, no service. That's where I think we should be right now.
Since when? A vaccine that's investigational, doesn't work completely, looks like it's grossly unsafe, that I have to gamble with my life to have my job, to go to school, or have my freedoms back?
Total violation of the Nuremberg Code, it would seem to me. I mean,
it's a total violation of our human ethics and our morality and our beneficence to one another in society. It's extraordinary what's going on. You know, it is an interesting time to be alive. I think a lot of us are on very short sleep cycles. It's one of the reasons why you're talking to me and I'm talking to you, is we see that something is disturbed. When Tucker Carlson had me on in May, and Tucker goes, "What's going on?" I said, "Tucker, I can't tell you. I'm just reporting the news. Something is up. Something is up. I think we've completely suppressed any form of treatment or help to people in order to promote the vaccine. Now the vaccine doesn't work completely, and it's frankly dangerous. We're down to almost one message. Take the vaccine or else." It's really boiling down to that. Take the vaccine or else. And it's the scariest time to be an American. And thank goodness half of Americans didn't take it. And so we're going to have to see what this is going to look like. I think the next month or so is going to be incredibly interesting. And it's going to be ominous. Let me tell you what, someone in my position, very, very worrisome and very ominous. I was on Laura Ingraham the other night, and they had announced the Federation of State Medical Boards is going to start hunting doctors and their licenses based on information versus misinformation. I was like, who decides that? Let me guess. I bet I'm not going to get a chance to decide. Someone's going to decide if I'm giving information or misinformation and take my license. Now they take my license. Now I don't have a livelihood. Can you imagine my immediate livelihood is now is up in the air on some type of arbitrary, potentially even nefariously motivated stakeholders in trouble. I told you last week, a major health system that I no longer work for, that I don't claim any leadership roles in, what have you, launched a crushing lawsuit against me. They're a billion-dollar company. I'm just a single person. You know, my wife and family are absolutely terrified that they're going to wipe out our future. I mean, this is absolutely astonishing that this could be happening. You and I are just having a fair interchange of ideas. I've tried to give you my best scientific interpretation. When I've testified in the U.S. Senate, I raised my hand. I said, I'm going to do my best. Same thing. These are my opinions. When I testified in the Texas Senate, somebody fact-checked me. And they said, oh, Dr. McCullough said something wrong in his Texas Senate testimony. You know who that was? That was a fact-checker reporter from France. Now, why is a guy in France fact-checking me in Austin, Texas? Do you know one of my other testimonies? The fact-checker was from Hong Kong. And then from Hong Kong, we traced her to China. And then from China, we chased her to Gates Foundation. It's like, well, wait a minute. You know, there's a hunting that's going on here that's very disturbing. Americans are trying to figure out. The average American doesn't want to know about the spike protein. They don't want to know about the nucleocapsid. They just want to get back to normal. Things were okay in their mind 2 years ago. What's happened over the last 2 years is a nightmare. And it's affecting all of our family members. We've all seen way too much death, despair, hospital transfers, rehab. We've had enough. Do you know what I mean? We've all had enough right now. And let's hope that sentiment, that public sentiment, will basically prevail. And that enough people will say, you know what? We're not taking the vaccine. And if enough people don't take the vaccine, this thing's going to die. And when it dies, potentially some investigative reporting can start to figure out, quote, what's behind it. No one can know. But that's the only way I see it. If there's capitulation, everyone says, listen, I got to take the vaccine. I need it for my job. And even though it doesn't work and I could die, I'm still going to take it. And we just pile on the injuries. We're going to have so many injured Americans. I can't even imagine what our clinic's going to look like this fall. And everybody capitulates. You know, the great fear is, it's like, okay, everybody, get in line now for the booster.